Our first speaker is Chuck Haddix. He is the director of the Marr Sound Archives at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. And he's also one hell of a guy. Chuck.
Vincent, I feel more manly already. When I asked Vincent, when I proposed this paper, I asked Vincent if I could do my paper early in the conference, and I didn't quite count on doing it this early anyway. And as Vincent said, I'm Chuck Haddix, and I direct the Marr Sound Archives at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Also, I'm a public radio producer for KCUR-FM, Kansas City's public radio station. I produce a radio program called The Fish Fry every Friday and Saturday nights. And in The Fish Fry, I suddenly turn into Chuck Haddock. So if I start introducing myself as Chuck Haddock, you'll understand why.
Chuck.
Yes.
Little problem. Technical difficulty here. I have somebody who has to give a greeting, who's asked to come in and do that. And if you can just let him have a few minutes.
Sure.
Then you can.
Sure.
I won't take away from your 45.
I've got a stay of execution, so we've got somebody coming up.
Hold on. Chuck's coming.
The governor just called.
I want to introduce Ted Johansson from Fiat. He wants to say a few words.
Yes, thank you. My name is Ted Johansson. I'm president for Fiat IAFTA. And I just welcome you, all Americans, to the United States. I hope you like it here. I appreciate very much staying here in this country. This is the third time I am here as a visitor. I went to the United States to be a little personal in 1964 and had a very, very good time. That's 30 years ago, and I still let you manage very well here. We have a quite an interesting program, as you will see documented, and you're all welcome to come to our sessions if you feel like. We have a lot in common, more in common than you should believe, because sounds, for television production, sound is more and more important. You can't run away from the past, and I have in my office often got requests about sounds only to be used in television productions. I know that there are problems in the sound archives to keep all recorded, and a lot of important records have been wiped out, sorry to say it. And therefore, the television archives often, as in Europe and in Norway, have to assist the radio with sounds taken from tapes. So if we work together, I think we will make quite a progress. And I think we have more in common than you should think of. I welcome you, and I hope you have a very good time here in Washington. You know the country better than I do, so I don't need to give you the whole history. Okay, see you later. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. And once again, from KC, Chuck Haddix.
We're going to be hosting the 1996 ARS Conference in May in Kansas City, and we hope to see you all there. Join us for 3 days of papers, round tables, good fellowship, and some of the finest barbecue you'll ever have as ARS jazzes it up in Kansas City. And my subject this morning is Raymond Scott. I first heard Raymond's music, like so many of my generation, in cartoons. I didn't even know I was listening to Raymond's music as I was delighting to the antics of Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, and Donald Duck glued to the television every Saturday morning. I also missed countless opportunities to become acquainted with the music of Raymond Scott by passing over hundreds of his 78s while rummaging through thrift stores looking for those elusive recordings of Robert Johnson and the other great blues masters. At that time, I wasn't sure what I was looking for, but I knew I was looking for something. All I knew about Raymond was that he was a band leader during the 30s and 40s and had vague recollections from my childhood that he had something to do with the hit parade. Now, thanks to Irwin Chusid, the man that handles the publishing for Raymond Scott, I've become somewhat obsessed with Raymond's music and his what I call his mad scientist mystique. Chusett was visiting a mutual friend in Kansas City, and he stopped by the archives to do some research to use the Wrigley Deutsch Index and our other resources. And we started talking, and he informed me that Raymond's wife, Mitzi, was looking for a home for Raymond's collection of open reel tapes and thousands of instantaneous cut discs. I began researching Raymond's career, listening to his music, and strangely enough, dreaming about him. And as William Butler Yeats reminds us, in dreams begin responsibility. My responsibilities were to come. In the fall of 1993, Dr. Sheldon, the director of the libraries, and the man out there at the registration table, and I went to Raymond's home in Van Nuys to look at his collection. Seth, would you dim the lights just a little bit so these slides come through? Irwin had told us that the collection was in rough shape, but we weren't really prepared for what we found. There were thousands of unique recordings spanning Raymond's entire career were in shambles. Let me see if I can get this to work here. There we go. Open reel tape recordings of Raymond's electronic music and the hit parade were strewn about in an old tool shed that was adjacent to the garage. They'd been knocked off their shelves by an earthquake. Aluminum and glass-based instantaneous cut discs and metal masters were stored in a garage with no insulation. We stood on shredded bits of sound covering the garage floor in front of the shelves that held Raymond's network recordings. We concurred with Chusett that something had to be done quickly, so we agreed to provide a home for the collection. The next spring, Ted and I flew to California and with the help of five volunteers packed the collection. While we were packing the collection, another earthquake struck. I was standing there sorting aluminum and glass-based instantaneous discs on this wobbly table. And I don't know if you've ever been in an earthquake, but it's like standing about 3 inches from a freight train rolling by at a very high speed. Naturally, I grabbed the table. Fortunately, no further damage was done, and the collection made it back safely to Kansas City. Since the collection contained so many glass discs, it was quite a perilous journey with Ted and I sharing the driving duties. As you can tell from Ted in action here, it was a lot of hard work, but well worth the effort as we found a treasure trove of network recordings by a true genius of music and electronics. Raymond Scott was a rare blend of inventor and composer. He was part Thomas Edison, part Frank Zappa, and he excelled at both disciplines. He is best known for his quirky compositions performed during the 1930s and 40s by his six-piece quintet. Compositions with names as animated as the music and as imaginative as the music, Egyptian Barn Dance, Dinner Music for a Pack of Hungry Cannibals, Powerhouse, and my favorite, Reckless Night on Board an Ocean Liner. Raymond was also a pioneer in the field of electronic music. In a Mixed magazine article in October of 1993, Robert Moog recalled how Scott was one of the first to develop a sequencer and how Scott was, quote, definitely in the forefront of using it commercially as a musician. Scott dubbed his first electronic creation Karloff. It stood 6 feet high and covered 30 feet of wall space. Other Scott creations include the Clavibox, an electronic instrument similar to the theremin, and the Electronium, an instantaneous composing machine. Scott never wrote a note for cartoons, but today he is known as the man who made cartoons swing, because Warner Brothers music director Carl Stalling used his music in over 100 Warner Brothers cartoons. Scott's music provided the perfect foil for the antics of that Wascally Wabbit and the other Warner Brothers cartoon characters. Ironically, Scott probably never knew that his music was used for cartoons. According to his first wife, Pearl, and his third wife, Mitzi, Raymond rarely watched TV, and he definitely never watched cartoons. Scott was born Harry Warnow, September 10, 1908. His parents were Russian immigrants, just 2 years off the boat, settled in Brooklyn, New York. Harry was exposed to music from the beginning. His father, owned a music store and was an amateur violinist. His brother, Mark Warnow, was a very talented violinist and conductor. Young Raymond planned to study engineering at the Brooklyn Polytechnic, but his brother, Mark, had other ideas. Mark was well paid as a staff conductor for CBS. He bought Harry a Steinway grand piano and paid his tuition to the Institute of Musical Art, which later became Juilliard. After his graduation in 1931, Harry was hired as a staff pianist by CBS. He played with his brother's Mark's orchestra and was also featured on sustaining programs. In 1932, he bought his first disc cutting machine and began experimenting with this new technology by recording his voice and piano at various distances from the microphone and documenting the distance on these aluminum discs. Like the early technology, these tests were somewhat primitive, but they're revealing of how Raymond's dual interest complemented one another from the beginning. We're going to hear a segment of an aluminum instantaneous disc from 32 of Raymond experimenting in his front room.
Speaking with a certain amount of tone now, about 10 inches in front of a universal condenser microphone, Model E, it says. I think it's Model E. It says something about E on the thing here. About 8 or 10 inches away from a universal microphone with a certain amount of tone. With a certain amount of tone. I think that record's going slowly again, so my voice will sound kind of funny in the first part of this test. That is until the record catches up. I mean, the belt must be slipping or something. We're going to play a little piano in this test, so I think it'll be much too loud, but we'll try it this way anyway. It's getting a new needle for that cutting head, because that doesn't seem to be cutting evenly, and after that, it'll probably be okay. The microphone, this condenser microphone, universal condenser standing right by the piano, we're going to cut a little bit of piano with it.
That's it, Seth. Around this time, Harry changed his name to Raymond Scott. He picked a name out of the New York telephone book, choosing it because it sounded good and had good rhythm. Raymond began writing tunes of his own, and these tunes were recorded with kind of mixed results by the Network Orchestra, the instrumentalists, and also people like Jerry Colonna. In 1936, Raymond persuaded CBS producer Herb Rosenthal to let him form a group to perform his work. Members of the quintet were drawn from the personnel of his brother's Mark's orchestra on CBS. And including Raymond, the quintet was actually a six-piece group. Raymond explained that he preferred the sound of the quintet. But I kind of think that Raymond saw it more as a vehicle. He saw himself separate from the quintet as a composer and also a musician. And they were more a vehicle for his quirky tunes. The quintet consisted of bassist Lou Shuby, tenor sax man Dave Harris, clarinetist Pete Pamiglio, drummer Johnny Williams, and initially trumpeter Benny Berrigan, who was later replaced by Dave Wade. The quintet proved to be the perfect vehicle for Raymond's strange and exotic compositions. As we hear with Reckless Night on board an ocean liner, Dave Wade's woozy trumpet launches a restless voyage across a musical dreamscape.
Thank you.
things about Raymond's music is we've all heard it before, but it's very subliminal. Now, that was taken from one of his early instantaneous cut discs, one of the first recordings of A Restless Night on Board an Ocean Liner, from one of the instantaneous cut discs in Raymond's collection. Raymond didn't write down the music for his quintet. The quintet learned Raymond's music by rote, with Raymond playing examples on the piano and then kind of coaxing the quintet, or urging the quintet, I think is closer description, as they rehearsed the band till they got it just right. And then they performed the music from memory, very tight unit. Dave Harris recalled how Raymond was a workaholic, quote, taskmaster, but only because he was so wrapped up in what he was doing. He didn't have time for kidding around. It had to be right. He wrote it, and he wanted it played correctly, end of quote. Here's a 1937 rehearsal recording, the quintet learning Twilight in Turkey, and you can hear Raymond in the background urging the band on and directing them through this. Raymond was obsessive about his recordings. He collected recordings throughout his career, and they represent all his phases of his career represented in the collection. This is Twilight in Turkey. Scott Quintet. Scott in a rehearsal there. The quintet. quintet gained greater exposure to the public through their appearance on the Saturday Night Swing Club. They were members of the orchestra, and the quintet would actually step out and play a few tunes. They didn't have many songs in their repertoire, so they kept playing the same songs over and over again, kind of like the birth of Top 40 radio. The Swing Club aired Saturday nights at 7 o'clock and had a very large listening audience of young people that liked swing music. And it made their appearance on Swing Club made them very successful. Here's an excerpt from the Saturday Night Swing Club. This is taken once again from an instantaneous disc. And this is probably one of Raymond's most popular songs, a song called Powerhouse. I think one thing about Raymond's music, there's quite a bit made about the world music movement today and how big world music is, and I think he was way into that years before anybody else, kind of like world music bebop. Here's an excerpt from the Swing Club with Powerhouse. Now store this one in your head because we're going to need this one later on. One thing about Raymond's music is there's abrupt changes in tempo. And when I was preparing for this, I was listening to this cassette at home, and my wife, Terry Matt, kept saying, no, that's not Powerhouse, because she'd only heard the first part of Powerhouse, and I was listening to the middle section, which is quite different. In 1937, Daryl Zanuck signed a quintet to a year contract with 20th Century Fox. I think this speaks to the popularity of the group. Raymond and the quintet appeared in a number of feature films and shorts, including Sally, Irene, and Mary, Nothing Sacred, Alibaba Goes to Town, and Happy Landing. And Alibaba Goes to Town and Sally and Mary, the quintet were dressed in costume, with Raymond in for minuet and jazz, and kind of an 18th century French costume, and for Ali Baba, this incredible Middle Eastern get-up with these fake beards playing these strange-looking instruments. Raymond wasn't too happy about being little more than a prop, so he didn't continue his movie career. Here's an excerpt from Happy Landing where the quintet performs War Dance of the Wooden Indians, and this is a video excerpt.
Number, I'd like to play a novel little piece of descriptive swing. It came to me one night out west. Raymond Scott and I were driving through a rainstorm. The only shelter we could find was an old abandoned warehouse. We crawled inside, and what do you think? We found the answer to the greatest riddle of modern times. Do you remember when you were kids and used to take a walk down the street? What was the first thing that struck your eye as you passed the corner cigar store? The wooden Indian. Have you ever paused to think what's become of the wooden Indian? Do you realize they're a vanished race? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we found their happy hunting grounds. That warehouse was packed with thousands of them. And as the rain beat against the roof and the wind howled down the chimney, we saw what no white man has ever seen before. The war dance for wooden Indians. Hold your scalps, pale faces, here we go again.
Decided to spare you the two wooden Indians dancing in the next segment of that film. As usual, when you had a band up there, you had to have the dancers along. In 1940, Scott left CBS and formed a new big band and took it on the road. Although the band was had a more mainstream appeal, Raymond continued to contribute his kind of idiosyncratic tunes like At an Arabian House Party, Eagle Beak, and Copyright 1950, which was actually written in 1940. Huckleberry Duck, one of Raymond's most popular compositions, was recorded at this time. Here's a Huckleberry Duck. returned to CBS, forming one of the first racially mixed studio orchestras, which featured Cozy Cole, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, and Charlie Shavers. In 1943, Scott sold the rights to Powerhouse, the Toy Trumpet, and some of his other early compositions to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers music director Carl Stalling realized that Rima's music was the perfect match for the antics of the Warner Brothers cartoon characters and quoted Rima's music in 115 cartoons. The use of Rima's music, of course, was an economic decision also, as Warner controlled the publishing rights. They didn't have to pay anything to use the music. In Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a Half Century, Carl Stalling quotes from Egyptian Barn Dance and Powerhouse. Here's the video segment of Duck Dodgers featuring Powerhouse.
Then make way for Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century. Oops, had the silly thing in reverse. Pursue to find Planet X. Starting from where we are, we go 33,600 turbo miles due up. Then west in an astral arc deviation to here. Then following the Great Circle, 7 radio loops south by down east. By astro-astrobo to here, here, and here. Then by space navigable compass to here, here, and then to here, and here. By 13-point stratocumulus bearing 4 million light years, and thus to our destination. Now, do you know how to reach Planet X?
Sure.
Well, I wish you'd explain it to me sometime, Buster.
It's very simple, sir. If we follow those planets, we can't very well miss Planet X.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Of all the stupid suggestions. Hey, wait a minute. I think I've got it. I'll just bet that if we follow those planets, we'll find Planet X. Yeah. How do I do it?
I don't know.
This is close to Powerhouse.
Stalling uses Raymond some music, and he just basically just quoted from it. And one of the reasons for the popularity of Raymond now is a project called the Carl Stalling Project, which really made a whole new generation aware of the contribution of Raymond Scott. In 1946, Raymond directed his attention to Broadway, composing the music to Bernard Hannigan's lyrics for the Broadway musical Lute Song, which starred Yul Brynner and Mary Martin. The show produced the hit Mountain High, Valley Low. Around this time, he began coaching a young Canadian vocalist named Dorothy Collins. Raymond was quite smitten by his young protege and began using her as a featured vocalist with his band. When Raymond's brother Mark died in 1949, Raymond assumed duties as a conductor for your Hit Parade Orchestra. From 1950 through 1957, he led the studio band for the Hit Parade and also did the arrangements for this network television show on NBC. He also composed the opening and closing themes, Be Happy and So Long for a While. 1950, Raymond separated from his wife Pearl and divorced her, and then later married Dorothy Collins. This marriage proved to be a mixed bag for Raymond's career, as he promoted Dorothy's career really at the expense of his own. He brought Dorothy aboard as one of the four featured vocalists on the Hit Parade, and the show began each week with Dorothy singing the Lucky Strike theme, which was composed by Raymond. On the Hit Parade, Raymond would stay pretty much in the background. During the opening shot of the band, there was always someone standing behind the cameraman making funny faces at Raymond so that he would smile for the camera. But with this commercial success, Raymond was able to pursue his first love, engineering. He installed a state-of-the-art recording studio in his home, and in 1948, he developed a $100,000 precursor to the synthesizer, the Karloff. And what he used was telephone switching equipment for the sequencer. And if you stood behind the Karloff, you couldn't hear the music out front for the sound of the clicking on the back of it. He used this for commercial soundtracks, and it could imitate the sound of coughs, wheezing, kitchen clatter. By 1949, Raymond had developed his first synthesizer, which would simulate conventional instruments by electronic means. Other inventions include a radio scanner and a videola he used for composing films. It sat on top of a piano, and he could sit and play the piano and to accompany the films and record the whole thing. And during the 1950s, Raymond develops a clavivox, which was similar to the theremin, only Raymond's invention, he used a keyboard instead of the wand. The sub-assembly was devised by a young engineering student at Columbia University, Robert Moog, who Raymond first met in 1957, and they became quite close friends. This is a prototype photo of the clavivox, although it was never marketed commercially. During the 60s, Raymond began using electronic music for the commercials. He'd always had a real flair for writing songs that kind of stuck with you. And he applied that to commercials with great success. And he was one of the first to use electronic music in commercials. Here's one of his commercials from 1962. This is a video of an Autolite Ford commercial. And if you kind of tune out the visuals and listen to it, you can hear Raymond using his synthesizer as an accompaniment.
Ford Motor Company switches to Autolite, Ford Falcon, Ford Galaxy, Ford Thunderbird, Mercury Comet, Mercury Monterey, and Lincoln Continental now specify Autolite spark plugs as standard equipment. They specify Autolite Power Tip, the first spark plug that cleans itself while you drive. It reaches deep into the intense heat of your engine. Lead deposits are burned off. It actually cleans itself while you drive. You get all the power and economy your car was made to deliver. Whatever make or model car you own, there's a set of Autolite Power Tip spark plugs, ignition engineered to power it properly. The spark plug selected by the Ford Motor Company for every car it builds. No matter what make of car you own, next time you need new spark plugs, ask for them by name. Autolite.
They also did the commercial for Rinso. We all remember Rinso. Those are quite funny. And during this period of his career, Raymond operated in a vacuum. Because of his paranoia that others would steal his ideas, he never published or worked with other colleagues except for Robert Moog, who he swore to secrecy. Fortunately, Raymond was obsessive about documenting his work, so we have some of his electronic music on open reel tapes, including a recording that's very strange called Limbo. This was recorded in July of 1966, and this allegedly features Jim Henson narrating a little tour of his brain. This is an audio cassette of Limbo, and it features Raymond on synthesizer.
You know, I've learned to walk around inside my own head. Now, that may sound silly to you, but it's been very, very helpful to me. Let me show you how it's done, in case you want to try it. Now, first I have to close my eyes, and then I go through certain mental configurations. And by this means, I can dissolve through the outer epidermal layer. And some other layers here. There. Now, when you first come to the brain, you have to pass through the medulla oblongata. That's where things like breathing and heartbeat and glands are controlled. It's kind of like plumbing. It's not very interesting. But if you keep going, you cross into the cerebrum. And that's where all your thoughts are. First game. see my evil thoughts. I keep them over here, in this part of my brain. And they're greedy thoughts. Gluttony. Hate. Lust. Well, that's enough of that.
Let's go into something nicer.
I've got a great collection of personal memories. They're right over this way.
Founder Barry Gordy hired Raymond to run the electronic music division. He moved to Los Angeles, where he worked from 72 to 1977. Raymond, during the 80s, dabbled at home and became kind of a recluse, always seeking, though, new scientific vistas with his dabbling in computers. In 1987, he suffered a series of strokes, which really cut him off from the rest of the world. He spent his days watching television and eating M&Ms. And during one of our visits, his wife Mitzi coaxed him out of the bedroom. And all he could say was, bye-bye. And these words really proved to be prophetic. Raymond died February 8, 1994. Unfortunately, Raymond passed without knowing that there was a great revival of his music, with Columbia and Stash reissuing CDs of his early recordings. And these reissues were largely due to the efforts of Irwin Chusett, who's really a one-man crusade for Raymond Scott. And one of our goals at the Sound Archives with the Raymond Scott Collection is to make more of these recordings available through cooperation with Irwin Chusett. And thanks to a pair of disgusting little cartoon creatures called Ren and Stimpy, Raymond's music is being discovered by a whole new generation, including my children. Well, I hope you enjoyed our little journey into the mind of Raymond Scott. Thank you very much.